Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow it just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbisn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Understanding autism. That's tonight's topic. Autism is a neurological developmental disability with an estimated prevalence of 1 to 2% of the American and worldwide population. And tonight we're going to discuss it with our guest, Jill Hill, who is Director of Family Engagement at the Partnership for Child Health. And she'll be joining us in about 15 minutes. But we're going to discuss the facets of autism that we may or may not understand, because with the onset of the increase, and that's our primary topic tonight, the 20 years at the turn of the millennium, we were at 1 in 150 children or people diagnosed with autism, 1 in 150. At the turn of the millennium, it's now 1 in 44 people diagnosed with autism. So tonight, when we get our guest and our co-host, Michelle, we will discuss this much more deeply. And before they join us, we'd like to, first of all, thank you for joining us. Another month, we are back on the air discussing anything head trauma, anything brain-related, and neurology is part of the brain. So we've been discussing Alzheimer's recently, and now autism. So welcome to Surviving Head Trauma with Terry and Michelle. She'll join us later. And we are the show that discusses anything you want to discuss. What you bring to us is what we cover for this month. And we appreciate you joining us. We hope that we are an informative show for you to hear tonight, whether you're listening to us live or to an archived show, whether it's morning, noon, or night. We appreciate you and hope we find you on the phone tonight. So if you'd like to join in the conversation or have questions, you may call the studio. If you're out of the United States, it's country code 1, and the area code is 424-243-9540. Once again, it's area code 424-243-9540. And if you'd like to speak or ask a question, press 1 on your phone, and I will see an emoji go up on the switchboard, which will notify me that you want to speak. So press 1 if you'd like to speak on air, especially once we're engaged with our guest and deep into the conversation about tonight's topic. We broadcast on this network every month on the fourth Thursday of the month between 10 p.m. and midnight Eastern Standard Time. And we would like to thank Craig Cecilia, who is the network owner and pays all the bills around here, and Kim Justice, network manager. She hosts a show every Wednesday, Recovery Now with Kim Justice. She keeps the shows and the hosts coordinated and organized and everything flowing smoothly here. So thank you, Craig, and thank you, Kim, and all the other hosts on Brain Injury Radio Network. There's a show every night of the week. In fact, the next show, actually this Sunday, is Lisa Dreyer's Mess with MS with Lisa Dreyer this Sunday. So tune in every night of the week. There's some episode going on this network. And with that said, we'd like to jump in. I'm Terry Smith, the writer of the book, Surviving Head Trauma. You can order that anywhere books are sold. And you may also find a Facebook page, Surviving Head Trauma, where daily information is posted. And you may also find every archived show that we've ever done on my website, terrysmithbooks.com. Now, we're going to hear from Brain Injury Association of America. There's someone you can turn to when you need guidance if you're new to this world of traumatic brain injury or any type of trauma or neurological issues. Back in 35 seconds.
Research, treatment, and support speed recovery for the more than 2.5 million children and adults who sustain traumatic brain injuries in the United States each year. March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Support research and better access to care and let people with brain injuries know that they are not alone. Call 1-800-444-6443 or visit www.biausa.org to learn more about brain injury.
BIAUSA.org, Brain Injury Association of America. They not only fight for us in Capitol Hill, I mean, they also help families across the country. So they fight for us on Capitol Hill for legislature that will help where it's needed, and they are there for you. So contact the chapter near you and get the guidance you need. So now we will discuss a little bit more about our guest tonight. She is Jill Hill, and she is Director of Family Engagement at the Partnership for Child Health. Now, Jill has been a guest on our show in the past, maybe 6 years ago, I think. So Jill started advocating for youth when her son was diagnosed with autism in 1999. It has become her life's passion to help parents have their voices heard about the needs of their child. Since then, she has worked with families to advocate in school systems, mental health services, and disability services across Florida. She believes that with training, coaching, and peer-to-peer support, families can receive the knowledge to successful advocacy for their child. Ms. Hill was a parent trainer coach for the state of Florida's Parent Training and Information Center, serving families in 30 counties. She developed relationships with public school systems to become an expert in special education law and at the same time advocating for families in schools. She is recognized by schools, districts, and families as the go-to person for special education issues. And since then, she has developed, well, she's now working with a parent educational engagement partners, believe parents are the fundamental building blocks in a child's health, well-being, and social, mental, and physical development. So PEEP, the name of the acronym, rather, for the Parent Educational Engagement Partners. And once she's on the air with us, she'll explain much more detail. But the specialized PEEP training and resources is a foundational knowledge and expertise shared by PEEPs with parents. And the PEEP is a specially trained parent of a child with a disability in the school district who has learned through their experience that positive teamwork among schools, agencies, and families is the key to a child's success. And PEEPs provide information to parents about resources, agencies, departments, and programs within the school system to help guide their decisions and educate them about available resources, which is something that we need when we're new to this world of neurological issues. So not every neurological issue is a traumatic one. Some of them are like this, autism, a neurological dysfunction that is something there at birth or developed later in life. So we we don't know a lot about it. So when we find ourselves introduced to something new, it's always good to have a resource of aid, someone to help us. Like the Brain Injury Association of America primarily deals with brain trauma, some type of external force creating injury, some type of brain accident. But this is a part of our show tonight because it's a neurological issue and we cover everything brain related. And this neurological issue is one that's becoming a major concern across all settings because there's no evidence of how it's acquired. There's not a marker in the gene structure. So in fact, there's an NBA veteran, Tony Snell, who says that he was diagnosed with autism at the age of 31. So we have a lot to learn about this. And we will discuss it in much more detail. And if you'd like to join the conversation, ask questions when our guest arrives, remember the phone number is country code 1, area code 424-243-9540. And with that said, I think we have Jill in the room with us. So let's get the studio switchboard and bring her on. I think this is, let me check the phone number because I can see everybody's number on the switchboard. Let me compare it to hers. And I think this is her. Let's bring her on the air. Round of applause for Jill Hill.
Hello, Terry.
Welcome.
How are you doing?
Great. Welcome to the show, Jill. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How are you this evening?
I am doing well. And how about yourself?
Well, excited to explore this new topic because we've talked about a lot of things on Surviving Head Trauma, and I was just letting our audience know that we're talking about autism tonight because it is a neurological dysfunction that fits under our title. So I've read to our audience your background and your role as director of family engagement at the Partnership for Child Health. But I'd like you to give our audience a little bit more of a background of your position in this world of ours.
Okay. All right. So, I wasn't always doing this type of work. I was actually in communications and marketing. And I actually worked for JTA doing that for a few years. I have a son who is now 27 that was diagnosed on the autism spectrum. And when he was diagnosed and started having issues in school, I kind of switched my whole life around and started advocating for him and started finding out more about the world of autism and disabilities and what can I do to not only help him but help other kids like him. And that led to me working for the state of Florida's Parent Training and Information Center. At the time, there was two, Florida Network on Disabilities and Central Florida Parent Center. And I worked for the Central Florida Parent Center. And so each state has one. It is funded under the IDEA law, which is the Individuals with Disability Education Act. And that's how I kind of got started in all this. And from there, I worked many years doing that and traveling around the state and working with families. And then I entered the world of mental health. So I worked with Mental Health America of Northeast Florida and the Jacksonville System of Care Initiative, which is called the Partnership for Child Health. and I've been with them for over 10 years, in one capacity or another. And now I work for them as the director of family engagement. And
I'm sorry, the director of what? I didn't hear the last thing you said.
Sure. The director of family engagement.
Ah, okay.
So I help our families in our community, support. We in the past have had support groups. For the Federation of Families is a national support group that we have a chapter of here. We used to have, monthly meetings and those kinds of things to help support families. And we also do trainings for families and for the community and for professionals as well. And anything that has to really do with family voice and choice, I help out with. And one of the programs I have been really wanting to develop for a long time, and our wonderful executive director, Dr. Vicki Wadewich, allowed me to go ahead and do this program called PEEP. It's P-E-E-P, and it stands for Parent Educational Engagement Partners. And it's kind of like a peer support partner, someone who has lived experience with their own child, with IEPs and 504s. And we help them attend IEP meetings, get ready for those meetings, and hopefully have better outcomes so that they will learn to do for themselves. So what we say is, we do for, we do with, and then we cheer on. But tonight we're talking about autism, and I have lived in that world for 27 years now. I was lucky when my son was diagnosed very young. Back then they did not diagnose that early. My mother actually worked at Early Steps, which is a 0-3 program. And she noticed some things right away, and I kept saying, oh, no, you don't know what you're talking about. And my mother, of course, said, this is what I do for a living. So I was lucky enough to get him diagnosed. But, of course, me being me and not listening to my mother, I had to go and get 5 other people to diagnose him as well.
Okay, Julie, so, sounds like a good point to jump in right now to find out.
Yeah.
As you're going on, I heard you said your mother pointed out things that you didn't necessarily believe. What were the things that she noticed to tip you off that this might be a situation?
She noticed that he from about birth to about 1.5, 2, he was developing fairly typically, meeting the milestones that you need to meet, crawling, turning when he heard his name, playing with toys appropriately, like if it was a truck, he'd run it, through the dirt and that kind of thing. And those kinds of things, that he was very social. He ate everything in the world. He loved to eat all kinds of different foods. And then he started to regress, where he started to lose some of his speech. He started to not want to socialize, and actually started to kind of pull away from people. If we called his name, it was almost as if he couldn't hear his name.
Which age is he at this point? You're saying that he started out fine and started regression. When did regression begin?
It was about two and a few months. By 2.5, he had been diagnosed. So back then, they did not diagnose till you were at least 5 or 6. Now they do diagnose earlier. And I was fortunate, like I said, to have a mother that she worked for Early Steps. She was their developmental specialist, and so she noticed those signs because that's what she did. And so I was very fortunate to have a mother that worked in that field. And so, you know, he stopped eating the foods that he liked. He limited his food. When he played with a truck, it was like he would line the trucks up. He didn't, like, play with them and, you know, in the dirt or sand or anymore. He didn't play with a friend. He played next to a friend. He didn't really want to socialize. He wanted to be in his own little space. So we started noticing those things more and more. And the behavior started happening because he could not tell us what he wanted verbally because he almost lost all of his speech. And we had to start speech therapy, language therapy, and everything.
And this is later than two. At two, he's not speaking. So when you say you had to start speech therapy, how old was he at this point?
He was speaking at two. He was saying, you know, one or two words, but he just was, and then stopped. It just stopped, and he really regressed, and his behaviors became worse. I mean, he was a good kid, but his behaviors became like frustrating behaviors would be, but he acted them out. So that's what everyone saw was angry behavior, not the frustrated behavior, because that's how it appeared. And so, you know, then we, of course, I did tons and tons of research and found that ABA therapy, which is applied behavioral analysis, works really well with children on the autism spectrum and adults. And so I immediately hired someone to come and help work with them. And also I went and got trained as well so that I could continue doing the work at home and understand the whole therapy and everything was behind it and those kinds of things. You know, those were the things that we did. Now, he'd gotten, by the time he was three, he started preschool. And by the time he was three and a half, he had gotten kicked out of two different private preschools.
Are these behavioral problems or not?
Behavioral problems. He wouldn't follow directions. You know, he had a mind of his own. He wanted to do his own thing when he wanted to do it. He just does not follow directions. Unless it's his idea, he doesn't want to do it.
Now, are these symptoms of typical autistic children, or are they unique to each child?
Each child is different. Each child comes with their own signs and symptoms. There are a few, that are similar, like speech delay, is usually, a pretty common one. It's common with all kids on the spectrum. And I don't want to say all, but I want to say a majority. Because that is, you know, most kids on the autism spectrum have a language delay. Now, autism spectrum has increased in the new DSM-5, which is the diagnostic manual that doctors look at. It now includes Asperger's, which is a higher level of functioning. So when I say autism, I'm really referring to what the old diagnosis of autism is. because Asperger's is a little different in that, you know, they could be, it's kind of like the person who's really smart but has no social cues. But you wouldn't think that anything was different, off on them. You would just think that they are awkward and you know, social situations.
Well, whereas, is there something that... I'm sorry, whereas with...
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just curious, I mean, with all these symptoms or the details that you're giving us, how is it that it's not noticeable with a marker of some type in the genetic makeup of the person?
They don't know what causes it. They do not know. You know, they've been studying it for a long time. They don't know what causes it. You know, there's lots of different theories out there.
There's a lot of what out there? I'm having... Your voice is a little...
There's lots of different theories out there as to what may cause it, but there's no one exact, you know, verified, this is what causes autism. So, you know, you have some families that only one person may, one child has gotten it. You may have it where all the children have gotten it. I know that in the past I've worked with like triplets, and all three of them had it. I've worked with twins where one had it and one did not. So you just don't know. You know, you would think it would be genetic because, you know, it would run in families, but then if they're identical twins, then why doesn't the other twin have it? So I mean, they've been doing genetic studies for years. They've been doing all kinds of studies, and there has not been one defiant answer as to what causes a child to have autism.
Okay. Well, I guess the big question, the big curiosity tonight is the numbers at the beginning before you came on the air, and that's in 2000, it was like 1 in 150 people, and now,
mm-hmm.
20 years later, it's 1 in 44. So, is there explanation of the rapid increase, or is that just something that's more revealed because of social media?
Well, that's the thing. Are we diagnosing it more because people are noticing the signs and symptoms more because we're talking about it more? Or is it that we have more kids that are actually on the spectrum, autism spectrum? So, you know, what is it? You know, we have mental health issues where 1 in 5 youth have a mental health disorder. Every year, we'll be diagnosed every year with a mental health disorder. Is that because we're talking about mental health conditions now, or we're getting kids to doctors to get evaluated, or is it because we have a larger population, or is it because, you know, we're all talking about it? You just don't know. And so I think it's a combination of everything, is that it probably is more children than before. I think it is more understanding and knowing the signs and symptoms to look for. I think that it is, just having that better knowledge base, especially schools, having that knowledge base as well, you know, the information is easily available out there on the internet too. I know that when my son, 27 years ago, if you looked up autism on the internet, there was very, very little there, And what was there was not good information. It was just basically telling you to put your child in an institution and leave them there. Because there was no positive outcomes. Today, there's positive outcomes all over. And so it's, you know, it. You have to kind of look at the positive outcomes and not focus on the negative ones, because otherwise it just, as a parent, it would eats me up. You know, I have to think the positives. What can he do? So there's a lot that he struggles with, but there's a lot that he can do to as well. And, you know, he may not fully be able to explain things to you about how he feels and what he's thinking, but he is very intelligent, and so it's sometimes it's very difficult, and he gets frustrated because he can't explain to you the way he wants you to understand. So but I mean, there are some other characteristics like delay in skills, delay in cognitive or learning skills, unusual eating or sleeping habits. I could tell you from the age of about 2.5 to about 5, I don't think he slept at night at all. You know, I'd have to drive around all night with him just to get him to sleep a few hours.
Would he sleep,
would
then
only
during
sleep
the day?
In the car?
Would he sleep during the day to make up for that?
No, he would only sleep if I drove him in the car. So,
I want to hear more about his life as from childhood until now. He's living independently, right?
Right.
First let's bring our guest host on and bring her into the conversation, and we'll explore what you've been through since birth up until now that he's independent. So hold on one second. Let's get our co-host in the air, Michelle.
Okay.
Michelle, are you with us?
Yes, I am with you. I'm here.
Well,
I've been
welcome.
Listening, but I was unable to participate up until now, but I have been listening. It's a very interesting story. Interested to know how you were able to progress from childhood to independence with your son. I've got a son in a similar situation, but he's only 16 right now.
Michelle, there's a lot of background sound. Are you? And there it stopped.
Oh, I need to put my headphone on. Sorry. Hold on.
Okay.
Is that a little bit better?
Well, there's very a lot of
I
wind. There's a lot of wind in your background. But.
Hold
Jill,
on.
I.
Yeah,
yeah, that's good. So, Jill, Michelle's our co-host, and she can relate, I think, a lot to this because she, as she just said, has a child who is on the spectrum. And Michelle, you heard the story,
yes,
so you know who Jill is. Yes, okay. So now
yes,
that you're.
Yes, I did have her info from Peeps and the. I did look up some of her info, so yes, I did.
Okay, so
research.
Yeah, she was just telling us about Peeps and her development. Your son, from early on until now at 27, living independently. Can you give us a little bit about that journey? What we might not understand, you might share something that give us a little bit more understanding of what autism means from experience?
Yeah, it means you have a crazy mother.
Oh, no. Is that the result?
No, it means you have a very strong advocate mother or parent, because I could tell you 25 years ago, or 24 years ago, when he entered into the public school system, he got his first IEP, and he was in preschool.
Wait, IEP?
And he has IEP, which is an individualized education plan. and it's for special education.
I'm sorry, Joe. Can you go, Michelle? Would you mute your Michelle? Hello.
Hello.
Could you mute your phone? I think there's a lot of background sound in your out of your speaker. All right. So Jill, I'm sorry. Can you?
So sure. Yeah. So so he got an IEP and he started when he was about 3 and a half in the public school system. He had a phenomenal preschool teacher. I mean, just wonderful. I still, you know, consider her a friend today. I could tell you every one of his teachers probably still knows my phone number by heart. That's how many times I would talk to his teachers a week. I was a little bit of a helicopter mom, but not really in that I wanted him to do for himself. Now, I was originally told when he got his IEP, hey, Mom, you don't need to really attend these meetings. You know, we will write these, these goals up for you. You don't need to be here. And so I, thinking that they're the experts, they know more than I do, that I really didn't need to attend. But I did anyway.
Wait,
and
need
I sat there.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Jill. Need a what? I didn't hear what you said.
I didn't need to attend the IEP meetings.
Oh, attend. Okay.
Which were the goals and things that would make up what my son would be learning and doing and everything like that. And I went anyway, but I really didn't say much. So I would leave the meeting thinking it was a good meeting. When he started kindergarten, he had to be switched to another school because they no longer had he no longer qualified for the developmentally delayed program. Back then, he was considered developmentally delayed, and then he moved into the autism classes, but. Because of the developmental delay labeled, he actually moved into severe emotional behavioral disorder class and at another school. And he was being, I was being told that he was being locked in a closet because of they couldn't handle his behaviors.
What
so,
type of behavior? What do you mean behaviors? What type of behavior?
That he just was not cooperative, that he wanted to do what he wanted to do when he wanted to do it. He was not potty trained. He was, he had lots of issues. He would yell when he was frustrated. He would, throw things, that kind of thing.
Now, are all the students in this classroom the same diagnosis?
They'd be
no,
diagnosed
just,
with other things.
I'm
but the
sorry,
thing
I
is
mean,
that it sounds like the school where he was placed was not able to meet his needs or cope with him. So rather than try and help him or adjust or in any kind of way cope, they just put him in a closet.
Right.
Is that kind of what's happening?
Yeah. So that's when he was about five.
Well, my curiosity, though, is if he's in a classroom with other autistic children, what made him stand out so much differently?
Some of them were not on the most of them were not on the spectrum. They were emotional behavioral disorders. So that is a different diagnosis than autism.
And I need to add, we talk about autism as if people understand or know, but it's not a, say, disease like cancer or diabetes or something that we can put in a cubbyhole and say, okay, this is autism. Autism is a range of different behaviors that may present in a different way. So to have a quote-unquote autistic classroom full of kids that all have the same autism is virtually impossible because with each kid, there are different things that may present themselves. Some may not like Some may not like to be touched. Some may be, like you said, he wasn't potty trained. So at least, you know, my son was potty trained and he was able to cope to a certain degree, but he just wasn't meeting the educational goals. And now that he's a teenager, he's having other issues that are coming up that I have to sort out. So, but I just want to make that point that, that autism is not a single thing that you just have and we can treat it with something or talk to you or coach you. It's a spectrum. So you can be very mild and maybe we can cope with behavior therapy and positive reinforcement, or it may be severe and we, you know, you may not be able to speak or be potty trained or have to only eat soft food. There are a lot of different issues. It's a range of things that present themselves differently in you, and it's really hard to put a label on each kid and say, these are the autistic kids, so we're going to do this with them.
You said he was transferred from one type of school to another for emotional needs, what made them change? Since you said he was transferred from...
Because the school system thought that that would be the best placement for him. And I, as a parent, didn't know any better. And so I followed along with the school. Now, when he got there and when I was having those issues, believe me, I read everything I could get my hands on about autism and about IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disability Education Act.
Okay.
And that is the federal law that for special education. And from that point on, I became his advocate and the school's, you know, pain in the neck kind of thing. So then I said, I want to know the schools. At that time, their classrooms were called autism classrooms. Now they're called CSS, their communication and social skills. So at that time, they were called autism classrooms. And I said, I want to know every school, a list of every school that has an autism classroom for kindergarten, first grade, what, you know, for elementary school. I went and visited every school, and I picked the school, and I went back in and had a meeting. Now, the principal of the school he was at didn't want to talk to me. So I sat there at her door for a week. She still wouldn't talk to me, and then I started calling around to hire people. And then we had a meeting, and I got him to the school that I wanted him at, in the classroom I wanted him with the teacher I wanted him with. And believe me, I asked questions that I never thought I'd have to ask. Like, if he starts to run, what are you going to do to prevent him? And I can tell you, many people said, oh, I'm just going to stand in front of the door and not let him leave. And that's not the answer I was looking for. I was looking for, I'm going to redirect him, and we're going to show him, get him to go in another direction and get him refocused. And that's what I wanted. Because if you just stand in the doorway, he's going to push you at some point because he's going to be bigger than you. And so you haven't taught him anything. So I would be at those, when I got him to the school that I wanted him at, I would be sitting there at those IEP meetings going, okay, how are we going to get this little boy who doesn't talk, isn't potty trained, to graduate high school? And I would have every person in that room look at me and say, Mom, I mean, they wouldn't even call me by my name. They'd say, Mom, do you understand your son is on, has autism? He's not going to graduate. I'm like, hello, do you understand? I'm Mom, and he's going to graduate. So I said, and if he doesn't graduate, if he doesn't graduate, at least he's going to get an education.
Right.
So
you were able to advocate for him. That's fantastic.
Right. Right. So that's when I started advocating for my son. And then other families started going, how are you getting this stuff for your kid? And I'm, you know, look, go read this law. And they're like, I don't get it. I don't understand it. And I'm like, I'll go with you to your next meeting. And then from there, I worked for the Parent Training and Information Center. And then from there, I actually became an ESE teacher. Just so I had the credentials.
So did you attend IEP meetings with other parents? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. And then I worked for the Parent Training and Information Center, and then that was my job to attend meetings with parents and then to also train parents on the laws and on their rights and responsibilities under those laws. And the program I have now, PEEPS, which is only in Duval County, is that program again, is a program like that again, except for I've hired parents who have lived experience that I put them through 40 hours of training on the law and how to be a peer support. And then I am coaching them through IEP meetings until they become comfortable or they become proficient enough to do it on their own with the families we get in. And it's a totally free program.
Now, can you tell us
so
a little bit more about
the
program? So that maybe is this something you plan to expand beyond the state of Florida, or is this something that you just want to maintain in this area?
Well, it's all based on funding because we receive grants. Where I work, we receive grants, and those grants, based on those grants, is where I can do what I do. If I had private funding, or if I had, you know, other kind of funding, then I could do other things. But right now, the funding that I do have is under a grant, which I'm very, very thankful for, because, you know, this is such a new way of helping families. It's very much needed. I've been to a couple of conferences, and nobody around the country is doing this. I mean, they help families, but they don't really help them in this way where you have we don't call them advocates. We call them supports because, you know, the word advocate seems so adversarial to schools. So if we say support parents, then it seems as though they're just like a peer coming in and helping the parent out. And so it doesn't seem as adversarial. And we want them to feel like, you know, they're coming in with a friend kind of thing.
How long have you had this model? How long has this model been exercised? How long have you been in existence?
We've only been up and running for about 4-5 months. And I could tell you last school year, we were trying to get the word out. And this school year, I am starting getting calls every day. So, because everybody started to hear about it and know that it's a free program and they really want to utilize the service. And we really want to focus on the urban core, like the Health Zone 1. And also Health Zone 4, but, you know, I don't turn anybody away. Anybody that calls and says, I need help, I'm going to walk them through how to do it. You know, and we have letters and communications that are forms that they could just fill in the information and send it on so they can get those meetings and everything like that. And I help families do that, and then they don't really need me unless they have a question, then they call me. Listen, I've been doing this for 20 years. I have families that call me maybe once every couple of years and will say, look, this year's going to be a hard IEP meeting for me. Can you tell me how I can get this? And then I'll tell them on the phone what to say, what to do, and then they'll call me back. They'll say, I got it, thank you, and then I won't hear from them again for a few more years. And then I hear from them then when the kid graduates high school. So, you know, it's just, So it's a nice feeling helping families out.
Well, how can our listening audience get in touch with you if they maybe want to model your peeps in their town or city?
So I work for the Partnership for Child Health. So if you Google that and go to the family engagement page, that's me. And on my email is Jill, J-I-L-L-H, for Jill Hill, at pchjax.org. Or I always give my cell phone number out. I just ask not to call me too late at night or too early in the morning. And that number is 904-376-5983. And anybody can reach me, you know, and I'm happy to talk to anyone. But we are you know, people have heard about us over the summer, and now they're back to school and wanting to get meetings set up with their school for the IEPs to get updated, and we are starting to get a lot of calls now. So I'm just, like, really proud about the program.
Okay, well, I don't need to jump all over the field here, but can you dispel some of the things? I've heard some crazy ideas that I don't know if they're crazy actually or not. Maybe you can help clarify. That older men with younger women is one of the reasons children are born with autism. Have you heard that?
No. I've heard that. Believe me, I've heard everything. But no.
Well, that's a myth.
That's a myth. Yeah.
What about adults who are diagnosed? Like for example, NBA veteran Tony Snell says that he was diagnosed with autism at the age of 31.
Yeah, no. Okay, so he may have had either very high functioning autism, or he may have Asperger's. And remember, Asperger's is now part of autism. And Asperger's is that high functioning, even higher functioning than high functioning autism. And it's just maybe some awkward social skills. You know, not understanding emotions very well or facial expressions. But sometimes they might be sound robotic or something like that. And they're not, don't understand body language or nonverbal gestures. So, but other than that, they may seem very much like everybody else. So, you know, that is part of the autism spectrum disorder. You know, you look at a huge range here. Like Michelle said, you look at a huge range. From extremely functional, extremely highly intelligent, you know, to gifted, to extremely low functioning. So you have a huge range, and it's not a disease, it's a disorder that, you know, they don't know the exact cause. Some think it might be genetic, but they don't know, you know, how. I mean, they haven't come up with a defiant answer yet. You know, some people, you know, years ago they thought it was the MMR shots that caused it. Some thought that, you know, the mercury in those MMR shots caused the autism. Some people thought that, you know, I mean, there was some crazy stuff that was coming out that thought that was the reason for so many kids starting to get autism. But now if you look at, but I can also tell you from my point of view, My daughter, when she was born, I made sure there was no thimerosal or mercury in any of her shots. She still got her shots, but I just made sure there was none of that in them, just as a precaution for me. But they don't know. They really don't know. You know, there could be no history of autism in either parent's family, and they could have a child that's on the spectrum. So,
Since your son has been with this since birth, I mean, what can you give us as far as expectations from leaving the house on his own? I mean, how's that working out for him?
So, for me, it's working out great. No. So I can tell you that school and getting him an education was very, very important. Getting his behaviors to a place where he could go out and not yell and scream at everybody was very important. So, like, he walks up to Target or to Michael's or to the grocery store, and he can go in and purchase his items. And, you know, he used to get really upset if he was over his – he knows exactly how much he has to spend. And if he goes over his amount, he would get really angry and he would yell. Well, one, I've introduced everybody at those stores that he goes to my son and explained to them that he has autism. This is the signs and symptoms of what you're going to see. Ignore the behavior and it will go away. Because if you give that behavior, attention, he is just going to prolong that behavior. And a lot of times it's just frustration. He'll go, and he'll go like that and scream. And then he'll calm himself down, and then he'll put the pack, whatever he has to put back, to make sure he stays within his dollar range, and then he's fine. You just have to not be scared when he does his, like, growling or kind of noise, because that's just how he gets rid of his frustrations.
And you said he's 27 now, right? He's 27?
Right. He's 27, yeah.
Okay.
And so school and home consistency. So that's why I think I knew all of his teachers' phone numbers, and all of his teachers knew my phone number, because home and school consistency was so very important. So if something happened at school, I knew about it when I picked him up, and we had a long ride home and a long conversation. So, about what had happened. And we all were on the same page as, if this happened, this is going to be the response. You know, so if it was, we're going to, we never took things away, like I wouldn't take away his phone, but I would limit his time watching TV at night. It wasn't taking away. It was just, like, limiting. Or he couldn't, he wanted to earn. He would always work towards earning something. And so that would be just points he didn't earn for that day. So that means it took him longer to earn whatever it was he was working towards. And so the more he understood that, the better that was. Now, it took him a long time to understand those concepts. And in the meantime, we put in short-term goals and objectives and those kinds of things where he would say he had a good day and there was no meltdowns or no yelling or throwing of things or anything like that. Then I'd stop and get him an icy, you know. Or if he went a whole week without any behaviors, you know, he loved to go to the bookstore. So we go to a bookstore. So, you know, come to find out, my son is an excellent reader, and can do math in his head, can do algebra in his head. And it was very frustrating. Yeah. So it was very frustrating with the school saying, well, we have to see his work. And I said, no, you don't. If he gets the answers right every time, you don't have to see his work. So that was one of his accommodations, was he didn't have to show his work. Go ahead, Terry.
Well, no, I'm listening. Go ahead.
So, I mean, and then when he got into, like, middle school, I wanted him to have more responsibility for things. And then when he got into high school, he was, I made him in charge of his IEP meetings, and so did the school. You know, he is getting to be an adult. He needs to run his own IEP meetings. And at home, I was, from the time he was 5 years on, I was teaching him how to do laundry, put the dishes in the dishwasher, turn the dishwasher on, you know, I mean, you know, at different times. You know, of course, we worked on potty training first. And, you know, how to cook, how to clean, how to do everything so that at some point in his life he would be able to live on his own so that, you know, because I have this theory that I have to teach him 1,000 times, and on the 1,001 time, he'll get it. And that's just the way my son learns. Every kid on the spectrum learns differently. So for him, he has to be shown it several, many, many hundreds of times before he gets the concept and gets it. And then once he's got it, he's got it.
How did you deal with the behavioral issues when he was in school? Was there a time when he was suspended, maybe, or were there any school issues with his behavior?
There was only one time that he was suspended, and I could tell you that I was actually proud of him because he was being bullied. It was in high school. He was being bullied by a kid. When my daughter was born, her name is Isabella, and we used to call him Max. And when Isabella was born, he decided he wanted to be called by his full name, Maxwell, because we were calling her by her full name, Isabella. So so the kids at school were teasing him by calling him Max, this one particular kid. And, of course, we also taught him to advocate for himself, you know, to let the school know, I can do this, or I don't want to do this, and explain why, you know, kind of things. So he would go to the school, up to the school office, guidance office, and say, look, I'm being bullied. You know, he would say it in the way he says things. This kid won't leave me alone. He keeps calling me Max. And that just irritated him so much. So one day he had had enough, and he went over and he punched this kid right in the face and knocked him out. And
literally knocked him out?
Knocked him to the ground. And part of me was jumping up and down for joy, going, good job for taking care of that boy. And the other part of me was going, oh, you shouldn't have hit him. So, you know,
yeah.
He had one day of suspension, so I made him mow the yard and do some work around the house. And then, you know, as his punishment, but because you can't hit kids, you can't hit people. But I was really proud of him for standing up for himself. And,
right.
I mean, you know.
I'm
so comprehensive. The amount of work that it took and that it takes, it's unbelievable. You know, like you said, okay, 1,000 times.
Yeah.
1,000 times. I mean, 100. People give up after 100. I'm in the spot where I've got to find some help for my son in school because he's like, he's just not coping well. And he's in a special school, but he's having trouble with just the assignments. He can get the work, but he's just very distracted, and he distracts others. And now I think he's having some little anger issues, so I'm trying to get all that together. But it's very good. It's amazing how just that positive reinforcement and over and repetitive thing, that whatever the thing you're trying to get the person to do, just don't give up. Maybe that.
I have a question for both of you.
Yeah.
I guess you could probably
not
help
giving
both.
Up is like. Not giving up is the thing. And I could tell you there are days along this journey where I just wanted to say, forget it. I got divorced about 13, 14 years ago. So I got to go through puberty with him. And I'm mom, and I'm supposed to be I'm not the one supposed to be teaching him how to stand up and pee, okay? So
listen,
he doesn't stand up to pee. I'm not supposed to be the one teaching him about, you know, morning issues and other issues.
Yes,
and so,
yes,
thankfully.
That's what adults do, uncomfortable stuff.
I know. Thankfully, the ask at ARC Jacksonville downtown on Davis Street has a phenomenal library where they had books, phenomenal book library that has some really good information in there with not photos but drawings, so that he could clearly understand puberty and understand why his body is doing certain things and why he wants to do certain things, kind of thing. But, you know, it's hard for I've heard people say, well, my child's on the autism spectrum. I didn't think they would go through puberty. I'm like, are you serious?
Yeah, right. And the thing is, there are many books. There are resources. I mean, I found one called Geist online. My neighbor.
Yeah.
One of my neighbors had it. And it was really good. It was about hygiene. It's about everything that you've just discussed. And I gave it to my kids, and we read it together, both my boys, because I'm a single parent too. And it's just the resources. I didn't want to have those conversations. But who's you know, when they started high school, I had one child that was not a typical child, able to do things. And then my youngest one is on the spectrum. And it's hard because I just found it very difficult, but I thought, you know, I've got one kid going to high school and one kid with special needs, and I've just got to do this. I don't want to.
Yeah.
You know, you think, oh, it's a man's job, or it's a job for somebody else, like you advocated for your son. If you don't do it, then nobody's gonna. They're gonna put him in the closet, put him in the corner. He's gonna be stuck somewhere forever. And then you feel like it. I tell my kids, my oldest one, that listen, my job as a parent is not to be your buddy or your friend. I like you. Not all the time, but I love you all the time. And if I don't if I don't have you in a position where you can take care of yourself and live without me, I failed as a parent. That really is my primary goal, for you to be independent and able to take care of yourself.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I really want that for both of my kids. I don't know how to do it. You know?
I can tell you it takes a lot of hard work, and you're doing the hard work. But I can tell you my son, power of attorney for his medical and financial needs, and I can tell you that his sister, who's younger than him, will end up handling his financial needs. The only reason I have a medical power of attorney is because he had to go into the hospital to have cataracts removed, and the hospital would not let him have the procedure. The doctor was fine with it because the doctor had been working with him, but the hospital would not unless I had power of attorney. And then I have it for his financial issues to make sure that everything gets paid on time. But,
Let me jump in. I'm curious now. You just said something. As an adult, they wouldn't treat him because of autism? Or why would the hospital hesitate if he's an adult? You had to have power of attorney.
Because he is on the autism spectrum. Because they believe that he was not cognitively capable of making a decision as to whether he could make the decision about his own surgery. So think that he, you know, was able to make that decision. And for their liability, they wanted somebody there that could make that decision.
Now, I know that you both explained that everyone's on different different part of the spectrum, but in general, as an adult, will people under the spectrum need some type of legal counsel like that for medical care?
Some may need guardianship. Some may just need power of attorney, and some may be fine all on their own. It's a spectrum, so it just depends on the needs of that person. And, people that are higher functioning and on maybe Asperger's and high functioning. My son is considered high functioning, but he's not the high functioning, I always want to say. But he is considered high functioning, but he can't. I mean, like, I have to tell him exactly how much money he has in the bank so he can spend it, like when he goes to the grocery store. Now, he's really good about not going over, but he couldn't go pay his light bill or anything like that. And as far as medical decisions, he tells me all the time when he needs to go see the doctor or when he needs to get his medication refilled or anything like that. But it's usually either a doctor's office or a hospital that's saying we need, an adult to have power of attorney or guardianship over him to make those decisions for our liability reasons.
You've stimulated a curiosity here then. So your son and Michelle, your son, you're both very an integral part of their lives. Both of you are doing a hands-on job as parent. But what do we do when our children are grown and we're no longer alive? Does that mean that anyone under the spectrum with not such a high end of the spectrum but will need care for their entire lives?
Yeah. So I have it planned out. Okay, so when you have a child born and they're considered typical, neurotypical, you don't have to plan out their whole life. You just go. You know, you take one day at a time. Maybe you plan for college. Maybe you plan for, think of, when they get married and you have grandchildren and, you know, you think about all those great things in life. You don't think about how you're going to have to take care of them the rest of your life. Because when my son was diagnosed, that was my first thought, is how am I going to take care of him when I'm no longer here? And so my big issue has been I need to set it up so that it's very clear and it's very easy for anyone to step in, if it's an attorney or if it's a special needs trust or if it's my daughter, to know exactly what to do. So my daughter has asked to do this. Now, I've also set it up so if she gets tired of doing it, then our attorney, we have a family attorney that can take care of it and manage it as well. And it would just stay within that practice and manage it until, but I mean, it's things you have to think about that you wouldn't normally think about. And so, you know, I started preparing for that when he was like 5 years old, because I wanted to make sure that if anything were to happen to me at any time, that he was going to be covered.
Okay, let me ask you this. For someone who's not so prepared and their child is alive and they pass on, is there some type of organization or like Brain Injury Association of America for brain trauma people? But what about the spectrum? Is there some type of organization for people who don't have advocates like you and Michelle? Is there some place they can turn for independent help?
There's the ABLE Trust. But again, parents have to go sign up their kid and everything. It's a special needs trust where you put money into it and somebody else manages it for you, for that person. So, you know, and so you can have that.
But what if the person doesn't have a lot of money to leave behind for the child? Is there a government or social organization?
Well, they could call if they're not making more than X number of dollars, they can qualify for Social Security and you know, and Medicaid and all that. So they would have that income. Now they can work, but they can't make over a certain amount of money, and then they would be they would have that as well. Now the one thing with Social Security is that you can't have more than $2,000 in the bank, but you can own a home.
Now, are you talking about the parents of the child or the actual child?
The
as
child
it becomes an adult.
Child.
The child, okay.
The adult child. So
the
when the child,
child
becomes an adult, if they want to go get Social Security disability, they can own a home, but they can't have more than $2,000 in the bank. So, so if parents pass, and their house is paid for, they should leave it to their adult disabled child, because they can keep that home if it's paid for and live in there until such time as they pass. And
excuse me, I'm sorry, until what?
And they still get their Social Security. And they can still get their Social Security checks.
Okay.
So because it's really hard to find a place to live on Social Security. It's almost impossible. So but there is also housing issues, you know, housing that you can get as well. I mean, you know, apply for like Section 8 housing. There's other entities that can help out, you know, just like with anybody else.
You just
have to know where they are
something.
And who to ask.
Can I add something, though, with you're talking about, you know, the housing, you know, there's another issue that comes up when you're talking about maybe low income or somewhere that's not as safe. You know, our people with autism are, you know, like you said, your son was a victim of bullying, but he was able to advocate for himself. There are so many children, and as we're talking about adults, who are in a position where they are easily duped or taken advantage of or conned out of their money. And so it may not be an idea. I mean, obviously it's not a good idea for everybody. Everybody doesn't qualify or have the ability to take care of themselves in that situation that's so free and open, some of the people would need more structure than provided in low-income housing, and that they that really may not be an option, you know, for some people. You need to,
and there is assisted living. There is assisted living places like the Arc Jacksonville has the Arc Village, and actually my son lived there for 2 years, and that was a great experience for him.
Okay.
So
no, that's in Jacksonville. But what about is there a national program like this?
I think I need to come up with Jacksonville. I think they're working on it.
For a national program? Okay. Well, then I think that we have a lot to learn yet. But you both, when you were both talking about the mourning issues with your sons and not being a man, and Michelle, you said we just have to step up to the plate. But that led me to another question I have for you. If there's a sexual development going on and they're not mature enough to how do they – is that possible to go on and have a family, or will they not understand that? How does that work?
So I can tell you that I have friends that have girls on the spectrum. Girls on the spectrum are a little different. There's not as many. But I can tell you one for sure has had her daughter had a hysterectomy done on her daughter, so she could not get pregnant. Because she is considered low functioning, and she did not want anything to happen to her daughter in the facility where she lives to cause her to have a pregnancy.
So what I'm hearing is that you're right. You have to think about something I hadn't even thought about. In those situations, you need to be concerned about if it's a girl. You're right. It's a high chance of vulnerability there.
Right.
So there's
a huge chance of vulnerability with a lot of things. I can tell you that I do work daily with my son on things that are, you don't answer the phone if you don't know that person that's calling you. You don't answer the door if you don't know the person. You know, you look out the little peephole, and if you don't know that person, you don't answer the door for them, kind of things. Just so that you don't sign your name to anything unless I say it's okay, or your sister says it's okay, or his grandmother. Because he can be taken advantage of so easily financially because he doesn't understand those things. And so it's really important for me to start instilling those things in him now. Well, I have been for the last few years, but, you know, now he calls me every day. Okay, Mom, I got this phone call. What should I do with it? And I'm like, you know what? You don't need to call me. You just don't answer it.
That's part of the autism. That's part of the disorder that, you know, they may be gullible or less suspicious of people. They're different. We talked about the spectrum being very wide. So some people are withdrawn. Some people are very overly friendly. And there might be a level of caution. There might be throwing caution to the wind. So it's all kinds of things that are going on. But a lot can be exploited and not safe, where a typical person may say, oh, I think that's too good to be true. It probably is. But we all want to get something for nothing. And our children are in the realm of, well, I guess it's true. Okay. I'll give you my number, social security number, and ID.
Oh my goodness!
I trust you.
That's you.
Right.
You so, yeah, I didn't even think about those issues to deal with. But so
and yeah, go ahead. And the other,
well,
you know, like
well,
you said,
what about families? And does that mean that it's unrealistic for a child with under the spectrum to expect a family of his or her own one day? Is that out of the realistic expectations?
No, no, no. It's not for those that are like Asperger's and high functioning. It's not unrealistic. I mean, I know that there are some families out there, and they're doing great. It's just they have to be, like if somebody had a mental health disorder, say they were schizophrenic and bipolar or something, they would want to make sure they were good and had a solid foundation before they tried to start a family, right? So if you had autism, you would hope that you had a good and solid foundation before you tried to start a family. So if you don't, then maybe that's not what you should do. Now, listen, my son loves babies to death, and he loves children.
Oh. About.
But he should never have a child. So,
because of the cognitive issues?
Because he wouldn't know exactly how to take care of one. I mean, like when my daughter was born, he was 9 years old, or 10 years old. And so he would, he would feed her with a bottle and that kind of stuff. But he had no idea anything beside that because that's all he ever saw on TV. Could he be taught? Yes, but it would take me 1,000 times to show him how to change a diaper, and he'd probably be grossed out by it more than anything. So, I mean, it's just, for him, I don't think it would be a good thing. For some others, it might be. So.
Okay, well, you said that you know of a young girl who was given a hysterectomy because of the fear of what might happen to her in different
right.
situations. What about boys? Are boys maybe given a vasectomy because of the fear of what they might do without thinking? Just naturally.
I haven't heard of any boys being given a vasectomy. I can tell you, my son can't get near a girl. So.
Yeah, I mean, we've got boys, but the thing is, these, those types of treatments are really, I would say, more antiquated. That people are being sterilized without
yeah.
their permission or things like that. So that is probably less common.
Uh huh.
Than what maybe you would think, but I probably maybe 30 years ago it might have been more common. I don't have any real numbers on that, but that's not really acceptable nowadays as a form
yeah.
of, I guess, population control, or it's really not like autism is catching, and they're not sure that there's like a genetic link. I mean, it's just too much unknown. So
right.
if you are high functioning like your son, if the person is on the spectrum and able to have these emotional connections, that maybe they would be suitable to be a parent. And the chances are that their children, I mean, my children are smarter than me, both of them, better than math than I ever was. And
yeah.
So who's to say? Are certain people shouldn't have parents, shouldn't have children? There are people that are typical adults having children and should not be parents. Just because
yeah.
you can have a child, you all know people who shouldn't have kids. We all have an example
Absolutely.
Of someone who doesn't really... kind of questionable.
Right. Right.
Might
and,
be
and,
Might
and
be somebody
you could
else.
Have two
two people on the spectrum and have a child is not on the spectrum. You can have two people that are not on the spectrum and have a child that is on the spectrum. So there is rhyme or reason. So,
right.
You know. And,
that's my point. I don't know what the genetic link is.
Well, that's me. I did in my research. I did read that there's no rhyme or reason that there's no racial or ethnic or any population where you live in the country geographical. There's no link to any commonality.
None.
So everyone's vulnerable
to this. And that's what's so frustrating.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Jill, what can we do to help
and
you promote
your... you brought it up earlier, the preservative in the vaccine may have some kind of some cause. There may be some cause linked to that, but it's not. It hasn't been enough to say that's definitively what it is. And what about the kids who didn't have those vaccines that still present with these symptoms?
And especially what gets me the most is the basketball player, the veteran, the NBA veteran, Tony Snell, diagnosed at 31. So there's really...
Well, he probably had it all of his life. He just got diagnosed at 31.
Right, which means he's extremely high-functioning.
Yeah.
And this is not new. It's always been around probably in some kind of... Well, for a long time. It's been around in some form. But people were coping. And we didn't have the stress or amount of information at our hand. We weren't overloaded with things.
Yeah, or like with mental health, they were put in an institution and no one, you know, they weren't seen.
Right.
You know, we know that, 70 years ago, there were institutions everywhere that if you were not, what we call normal, you were put there.
The sanitarium.
Yeah. So.
Well, Jill, what can we do to help you get your program off the ground and maybe expand it from just Jacksonville to other locations? Because it sounds as if what you're doing is a step in the right direction that could be spread to a greater area.
Definitely. I mean, I need to. I'm gonna sign up for a class. I need that 40 hours of training tomorrow.
You don't think I was listening?
I was listening, and I'm taking notes.
Well, now I believe you. I believe you now. You just gave us something. You're right. That was said before you came on. Is there a virtual class that you can teach this program?
There is a virtual class. I do have trainings that I can do. And I have done in the past. I can set them up, and then I can set up maybe in September a virtual class, and then get the word out and let you guys know.
Oh, great!
Well,
I'm there.
All right. Well, Michelle, you have any more questions for her before we let her go, and maybe you and I can talk about this for the rest of the night, or if you don't have any more questions,
we can talk about this for the rest of the year.
Yeah. Well, you and I will, but I...
No, I just applaud. I applaud Jill for her dedication and ability to advocate for her son and help others in need, because the resources are so sketchy and scattered and piecemeal. It's very difficult to navigate, and it's really nice, just refreshing to see someone has put the pieces together, not only for themselves, but being able to disseminate the information and give people what they need to get their kids independent as much as possible. It's really great.
I agree, yes. We both commend you on that. But, I mean, if you don't have any other questions, Michelle, I guess we can just ask Jill for one more time to let our audience know how to reach her. Do you have anything else to ask?
No, I'm good. I'm
going
to call
her.
I'm going to that class.
All right.
Well, Jill,
I'll set it up for September then.
Well, Jill, yeah. we'll let you go for the evening after you give our audience another one more shout-out of how to reach you and get in touch with you with this program, Peeps.
Okay. All right. For Peeps, my email is J-I-L-L-H at P-C-H-J-A-X.org, or my cell phone. You can text me or call me, but not now. Not late at night and not early in the morning, but, you know, regular business hours.
And we're
is,
in East Standard Time.
904-376-5983.
Okay. All right. Well, thank
so
you for
you
all that you've done.
That, or you can go to Partnership for Child Health website and go to the family engagement page, and my information is there as well, as well as all the listing of all the trainings we I do in the community. You can have a listing there of everything.
Okay. Now, I'm on the page right now, Partnership for Child Health. Where do I find you?
Yeah. You go to the, hold on, I'll have to, I'm on my computer part. Partnership.
Did you say information page? There's a link.
For child health.
Yeah. You were talking, I didn't write it down, but you said go to the link,
okay.
The info.
Go to, okay, a partnership for child health, and then, there should be a link to the taking forever to come up. Areas of impact. If you click, just scroll over areas of impact, you'll see family engagement for mental health. Click on that.
Gotcha.
And then that is, and then you scroll down, you'll see peace.
Yeah, I see.
And
yeah, I
you'll
got
also
you.
See family resources. Well, those are mental health resources for the Northeast Florida community. And then you'll see a long list of trainings that I do around the country. So, and,
that's amazing.
Oh, yeah. This is a great site. You got to check this out. This is partnershipforchildhealth.org.
Child health, right. Yep.
Yeah, so check that out. All right, Jill, you've been a great help site. What's that?
Yep. So I was going to say, down at the bottom, you'll see that we rank 50th out of 50 states in mental health funding. One in five children live with a diagnosed mental health disorder. Only 20% of children with mental health issues are identified. And suicide is the second leading cause of death for 15 to 24-year-olds.
This is not
good. There is lots of good information on this website. So just kind of pick around at it and you'll see.
Okay.
And we have some really good programs.
Those numbers are atrocious for Florida.
I know, but you're the last one in the country for mental health funding. Okay, well then we'll have a part two when you're ready to talk
about
your.
Got some work to do.
Yeah, there's a lot of work.
That's right.
But Jill, we so appreciate you helping us understand autism a little better tonight. I mean, I really appreciate it because I am I'm flabbergasted that there's not more information out there about it. But I guess it's such we're evolving so quickly that there's not enough information to.
Well, there's a ton more information now than there was 20 years ago. So, you know.
Okay. Well, with your hard work, I'm sure that we'll have even more in the next decade. So we'll keep working towards this. All right. Well, Jill, thank you so much for joining us this evening. All right.
Yeah,
well,
I love it.
Thank you for joining us.
Good night, Jill. Thank you.
Good night.
Good
night, guys.
Good night, Jill.
All right. Bye.
All right, let's take Jill off the switchboard. And Michelle, I hope that she was helpful to you with your involvement with the spectrum.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's going to be great. I can't wait to do this class with her in September. The website is very informative.
Yeah, I'm looking at it here, and yeah. So I don't understand why there's not more organization like this in the country when autism is growing so rapidly in the last 20 years. But
well,
I have a list here.
She said Florida is last.
That what?
She said Florida is one of the last.
Oh, yeah, it is.
The last place with mental health issues. And this kind of falls, it's healthcare, it's mental health, it's behavior. So there's so many facets. It's difficult to cubbyhole this one disease under the umbrella of autism spectrum. And one size does not fit all.
Yeah. When you say mental health, though, you tend to think of a bigger spectrum than just autism. You tend to think of mental health with all kinds of things, Alzheimer's. But Florida ranking 50th out of 50 states in mental health funding is sad. But I guess there is, if you're ranking from state to state, every state's going to be different. But it seems like there should be some type of national organization that can reach out. Have you found anything that maybe Jill didn't share with us about your learning experience having a child on the spectrum?
Well, I did have some better help, H-E-L-P, when we were in Colorado, and also England had more of a grasp because it's a national health system, so my kids were born over there. So that was a bit different. But when we were in England, I didn't know that my kids were afflicted with this, this disability. So I've been navigating the system and all these things, moving around. And like she said, once you get to a place where you think you're in a good spot, the kid will age out of a program, you'll move, or something will happen. And these kids do not do well with change of their routine. It's really difficult. And she's really dedicated and has her work cut out because, like she said, 1,000 times to do something, to learn a new skill, that's just dedication. That's many people would give up. I've given up on certain things.
So what keeps you going? Love? Is it pure love that is your fuel to keep going then?
But I know that my kid understands me. It's not, he's smart, very intelligent, and it's just like a social piece that he's missing, that gullibleness and that childish innocence is there. But now that he's an adolescent, he's a teenager, so there's other things coming out and hormones, and it's just he's changing. He's growing up. So she's taught me that not to give up and to continue training him however many times it takes that he may get it. It just may take 1,000. Don't give up at 500 or 900. Keep going. It may be a skill. It's possible that whatever skill I'm trying to teach him, he may be able to get it. So I really want him to improve his social skills. And there are some programs here in different places. I've heard of, there's a national one called CARD, Center for Autism and Related Disorders. That's an organization that helps coordinate things.
Is it a national organization?
I think CARD is coast to coast. I think so. Yeah,
what's the name again?
CARD. Center
oh, CARD.
For Autism and Related Disorders.
Okay.
CARD. CARD.
All right.
Yeah. You see it?
Yeah, I'm just hoping that we can find something national for our audience to tune into. But what we did not cover tonight were actually like specific little things, I think. And I have a list here, and you can tell me if you recognize any of these traits for our audience, if you, I gave the phone number out at the beginning of the show, but with only 15 minutes left, I'll give it out one more time in case anyone wants to call in with a question or a comment. Area code 424-243-9540. And if you'd like to speak on air, press 1 on your pad and we'll see an emoji go up. But what I'd like to do now is go over the list and let you check what you recognize and what maybe you can add something to this list. So if you're listening and you see these traits in your child or even adult, as we just learned, that you could be diagnosed late in life at 31. Our veteran Tony, Tony Snell, diagnosed at 31.
This is the thing. Like, just because you're diagnosed late doesn't mean you didn't have it.
Right.
It's not something that comes on as an adult. He was able to cope and manage whatever the symptoms he was having. And they're wide, they're varied. There's probably, I don't know, hundreds of, I don't want to say symptoms, but hundreds of behaviors and issues that could come out. And if you have a certain number of them, that's where the diagnosis comes in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like a checklist. And if you check a certain number, you're positive, or you don't reach that number, you're not. Right. Okay. Let's get on the list. The first one says avoids eye contact or does not keep eye contact. The next one is does not respond to name by 9 months of age. The next one does not show facial expressions. He didn't respond to his name?
Yeah, I had that name thing. So when we took him to my son to the daycare, he was okay. But when they called his name, he didn't recognize it. Like, he didn't answer as if it wasn't his name. So they said, oh, that was one of my first clues.
How old was he at that point?
Like three.
Okay.
Does he go by a nickname? And I said, oh, no, it's just his name. Oh, well, when we call him, he doesn't answer.
So you thought it was
respond,
a hearing problem, maybe?
But it's not a hearing problem. It's autism. Wake up.
I know. I'm saying it was a question. Did you initially then, after they said he didn't reply, did you think it was a hearing problem?
No, because he talks and was, well, he was not, no, because he would react to sound. So he wasn't
It's not
deaf.
His name. Okay.
Yeah, it was just like his name was not a meaningful word to him, and he didn't respond to it. It was really, I'm telling you, oddness, very odd behavior. It's odd.
All right.
So,
well, the next one says,
you're talking to somebody, they look at you, not autism. Maybe. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But go on, down the list. It's probably like 100. Go, let's go.
Well, no, this one's not that many. The next one is, does not show facial expressions like happy, sad, angry, and surprised by 9 months of age.
Mm, okay.
Does not play simple interactive games.
Those are
like
those are mile markers, like, you know, things, like when the baby's born, they have this scale that you should be doing as soon as you're born, and the doctors give you a rating, because there's 10 things or something like that, or the score is 10, that a newborn baby should be able to do. So if you're low on that, they expect. I forgot what it's called, like an Apgar scale or something it's called.
Is this to determine the mental acuity of the child,
no,
or what is this test for? Just the functions of healthy baby?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Apgar score, APGAR. It's a score given to newborns soon after birth. It checks the heart rate, muscle tone, and other signs just to verify medically, to see if extra medical care or emergency care is required. So they'll, if the baby doesn't get a good score, they'll give it again after a minute, and then after another 4 or 5 minutes. So there's like a time limit. And if the baby doesn't get between a 7 or a 10, if they don't pass these things, then they will begin some type of emergency care or medical treatment or some evaluation.
You said this is at birth, at the time of birth?
Yeah, correct. 1 minute after birth.
One minute after birth,
the baby should be able to do, I don't know, they spank the baby so he cries. They, you know, you see them spank the baby, right, when they're born.
Right.
Yeah,
that's part of it. Okay.
Yeah. So well, there are a few things they should be able to do, and so when they don't, they suspect something's wrong.
Okay, but it's not necessarily autism. It's not all there. Like, that's a general test for health and well-being.
Right, but generally, if you can't do those things at 1 minute, there may be something wrong.
There's
but
some
1 minute old is a little bit young to say, oh, it's autism. You know, you have to do other things.
Right.
You have to fail to meet other age-appropriate milestones, like talking, like the eye contact, following a sound, saying your mom and dad at a particular age, walking. I just did a questionnaire for my son, and it's for older kids, but it was very, very comprehensive.
Is this when he was first born?
No, this is, I just recently, yesterday.
Recently, you said. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And so it asked some of those, because those behaviors carry on with them. If they're not looking, using eye contact, they have to be taught that then. And then they're not going to pick it up after somebody tells them 25 times. It's 1,000. So how many people are going to get the kid to explain something 1,000 times to someone? You give up after about 10, generally.
Well, it's a life journey. It sounds as if it really is a life journey.
Intense. Listening to Jill, it's intense. So tell me, what else? So the name, not answer
well,
to your name.
The next one is, does not play simple interactive games like Pat a Cake and by 12 months of age. So the next one after that is uses few or no gestures by 12 months of age. For example, does not wave goodbye. No gestures. Mm-hmm. All right. The next one is does not share interest with others by 15 months of age. For example, shows you an object that they like. They don't show any interest or share interest with you by 15 months. They don't seem to be focused.
Well, you know, kids are odd because if you look at the young ages where you think they're playing together, they're playing side by side. I did learn that.
Not with each other?
Right. There's an age before 15 months. I don't know what the age is. That it's a preschool age or maybe it's around 15 months, 2 years old, where the kids will play nearby each other, or they may play with similar toys. You know, like you'll need two trucks and they'll be running the trucks side by side, but they don't, they have a internal game going. I don't know. There's an age where the kids start playing together.
Does this mean that social media and all the computer gadgets and phone, iPhones, iPads, all the different electronic things that isolate us from each other now is a bad thing or a good thing for them? Because they're certainly not going to learn social interaction with the onset of individualized phones and gadgets. So is electronic going to make it worse, I think, for children who have already trouble interacting?
But I don't know, because it is for some kids that don't talk. There are talking devices. So, you know,
okay.
There are I don't know what's right. I can't.
Well, the next one here says, does not point to show you something interesting by 18 months of age. And then does not notice.
Remember I was saying that the kids won't meet certain goals, age-appropriate goals. And, okay, not being able to do certain things, a few of those, isn't anything to be alarmed about. When it's numerous and they're not fitting in and they're falling behind their peers, that's usually about 3 or 4. That's usually when they start school or they're interacting with more kids. And that's when you want your kids really to be socialized. And if
they're not
socialized by 4, then you got a problem because they won't be able to interact at school properly. They won't perhaps learn or be able to grasp new ideas and skills. So 3, 4 years old, they've got to meet those goals, those check marks, those milestones that you're speaking of.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you got a problem.
Well, that's what Jill was saying. Early diagnosis is a big step in the right direction, and she, with her mother's aid, found out early on, so that seems to be of an advantage. But the next one is, does not notice when others are hurt or upset by 24 months of age, or 2 years. When they're 2 years old, if they don't notice other people being hurt or upset, that's a sign. Does not notice other children and join them in play by 3 years of age. Does not pretend to be something else, like a teacher or a superhero, during play by 48 months of age. Why did they break down babies 48 months? What's that, 4 years?
Right.
4 times 12, yeah. So 4 years old, they should be pretending to be, and using their imagination. But 60 months, what is that, 5 years? 60 months of age.
Yeah.
Does not sing,
dance, or act
for you.
These are like abstract kind of concepts, really, because not everybody's going to have all these things, and these are not indicative of, you can't self-diagnose because you missed something. It's a spectrum of a disorder. So not being able to imagine yourself as a pilot or, you know, rocket scientist or whatever kids do, a fireman, is not an indication that you've got this disability. It's just, you know, it could be something else. It could be, I don't know what it could be, but I'm just saying that having a few of these things that you're listing or missing milestones is not a diagnosis. However,
it's a checklist.
All of these things are...
Yeah, when you go down the list and start adding them up together, like there's another list here. It says examples of restricted or repetitive behaviors and interests related to ASD can include lining up toys or other objects and gets upset when the order is changed. So they need repetition or they need routine. Repeats words or phrases over and over and over. Plays with toys the same way every time. Is focused on parts of objects, for example, the wheels of a car, not the whole thing, just the wheels. Gets upset over minor changes, has obsessive interests, must follow routines, flaps hands and body, rocks body, spins self in circles, has unusual reactions to the way things sound, smell, taste, look, or feel. So you're right, there's a lot of lists.
Right, it's a huge list. It's not exhaust. You haven't covered everything, but
touch bases. I hope that we've helped somebody to understand a little bit more, because we're down to 45 seconds for this month's episode.
Wow.
45 seconds. Yeah. Well, actually 39 seconds now. So Michelle, I'd like to thank you for joining us this evening with our guest Jill Hill.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and we'd like to thank our listening audience for joining us. And again, whether you're listening to us live or to an archived show, morning, noon, evening, we wish you love and better understanding of life and all the things that happen in life, like trauma or things we're born with. 10 seconds left. Michelle, want to say goodnight?
10 seconds left. I don't have anything to add except this is a great show. Glad you found Jill. She's a wonderful human being.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you for joining us. We'll see you next month in September. So until then, we wish you love. Michelle, good night.
All right. Good night, Terry.
Good night, everyone. Michelle, bye.
Bye.